this is a special podcast of the National Secular Society's Secularism 2012 conference, which took place on the 22nd of September 2012. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion, which is a weekly news magazine podcast about interesting things. From politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical, rationalist, pro-secularist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. In this podcast, we'll hear from Peter Tatchell, who has been campaigning for human rights, democracy, LGBT freedom and global justice since 1967. Through the Peter Tatchell Foundation, he campaigns for human rights in Britain and internationally. In 2012, Peter was awarded the Irwin Prize for Secularist of the Year. But now, let's hear him speak at the NSS conference.
Thank you very much. It's a great honour to join with you today at this conference, where we affirm the values and importance of secularism in our society and worldwide against those who would give religion privileged status and power within society. The theme of today's talk from me is organized religion is the greatest global threat to human rights. Now, of course, there are many, many threats to human rights around the world. I guess it all depends on, in part, how you define human rights. Traditionally, human rights have been defined rather narrowly in terms of freedom of expression, the right to protest, freedom from torture, and so on. But of course, in the last century, concepts of human rights evolved, and we now have United Nations conventions and covenants, like the UN Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, that define human rights much broader than mere liberty and freedom, important though they are. These rights, these human rights, include things like the right to food, shelter, education, and healthcare. And in my view, these too are human rights. For how can you exercise your right to freedom and liberty if you don't have the basics to actually live and survive? If you haven't got food and water, if you haven't got the wherewithal to withstand adverse weather conditions, how can you exercise these other freedoms? So to me, by this definition, probably one of the greatest threats to global human rights is the global economic system, which is responsible for the fact that so many people do not have the basics for life. So many people do not have the basics and fundamentals to live, and they are dying as a consequence. We live in a world of plenty, of immense global wealth, yet that wealth is very clearly, unfairly, and unequally distributed. 1,000 million people today will be hungry, malnourished, or have no safe, clean drinking water. 1,000 million people. Today and every day, 5,000 babies will die from dirty drinking water, from the infectious diseases carried by dirty drinking water. 2,000 million people on our planet live in slums and shantytowns. 1,000 million don't have basic education. Tens of millions die every year from preventable diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, typhoid, cholera, HIV, and dysentery. Nearly 400 million people on our planet are needlessly blind, mostly caused by deficiencies in vitamin A and by riverborne infectious diseases. So to me, this vast suffering in humanity is not an accident. It is the result, the clear result, of a global economic system that gives some sections of the global population immense wealth, and others are left in a state of semi-destitution. It's an unfair global system based on a free market capitalist ethos, and it does allow for us in the West to live in relative luxury while two-thirds of the world have not. I think we need to change that system. We need to ensure a different economic system, to organize the world economy differently, and thereby we could ensure that every person on this planet does have a decent quality of life, that they have economic and social rights. But when it comes to traditional human rights, as I said, freedom of speech, the right to protest, then I think we see a different picture. If you look at that spectrum of human rights, freedom and liberty, we see that the single greatest global threat is organized religion. Not necessarily people of faith per se, but religious leaders and organizations. And I think this is a very important distinction. It's about priorities and about focusing on the main problem. Religion may be irrational and superstitious. It may be a misunderstanding of the world and our place in it. It may hold back scientific knowledge and lead people to believe things that are palpably without evidence. But nevertheless, religious belief per se is not necessarily confluent with abuses of human rights. Indeed, there are some religious people who are in the forefront of campaigns for human rights. So when I look at history, I see people like Martin Luther King, Dorothy Day, and Archbishops Desmond Tutu and Oscar Mario, who stood out for social justice, freedom, liberty, and equality. I see the liberation theologians of Latin America, who, despite their religious views, championed the poor and challenged dictatorship. But they are, of course, very different from organized religion. And I would say that they have not been on the side of the angels. They have too often backed tyrants and torturers, and still often do. If we look at Russia today, we see how the Orthodox Church is colluding with the increasingly totalitarian regime of Vladimir Putin. The whole controversy around the Pussy Riot protest and the jailing of those women, that's just the tip of the iceberg of the way in which the Russian Orthodox Church provides a cover and a justification for the Russian state. But of course, that is not alone. We see similar religious organizations and leaders taking similar stands in many other countries. In Zimbabwe, a faction of the Anglican Church has backed the Zimbabwean tyrant, Robert Mugabe. In Uganda, again, a faction of the Anglican Church has backed President Yoweri Museveni, who increasingly is the new Robert Mugabe of Africa. We all know that for so long, successive popes and Catholic leaders have sought religious privileges, special access and status within government, and exemptions from equality laws, even here in Britain. We know that the Vatican has for a long time lobbied to prevent democratic governments legalizing contraception, abortion, euthanasia, stem cell research, donor insemination, and adoption by same-sex couples. It's even opposed the provision of life-saving condoms to prevent the spread of HIV, clearly putting people's lives at risk, and in many ways, over many years, colluding with the deaths of many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. In some instances, of course, the Catholic Church has even threatened to excommunicate grassroots Catholics who have supported these liberalizations. So again, we must remember that there are people, even within the Catholic Church, who dissent from the Vatican and papal decree. In fact, polls in Britain have shown that the vast majority of British Catholics disagree with the Pope on contraception, abortion, and homosexuality. Likewise, all across the Muslim world, we see both mainstream clerics and lay believers demanding the execution of Muslims who turn away from their faith, the execution of women who have sex outside of marriage, and the execution of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. We also see the widespread persecution in Muslim lands of religious minorities, Christians, Baha'is, Hindus, Sikhs, and even fellow Muslims. In Iran, which is a Shia Muslim-dominated state, Sunni Muslims face restrictions and persecutions. Across the border in Pakistan, where there's a Sunni Muslim majority, Shia Muslims face persecution and a discrimination. And of course, all across the Muslim world, Ahmadiyya Muslims face persecution by their fellow Muslims. In most Islamic states, such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, the media is censored. Trade unions and political parties are banned or restricted. Women are pressured or forced to cover their heads or their whole bodies. Secular, liberal, and left-wing movements are outlawed. Freedom of expression and the right to protest is severely constrained and subject to government approval and control. Liberty is barely existent. And who are the main victims? The main victims, of course, in this Muslim persecution are fellow Muslims. They are the ones who bear the brunt of this religious-inspired attack upon liberty and freedom. So for all these varied reasons, organized religion is surely the single greatest threat to freedom and liberty. However critical some of us may be of religion, and I am, it is religious leaders and their power structures, not people of faith per se, that most seriously menace liberty and freedom. Indeed, we can and should work with those religious people who share our commitment to universal human rights. We need to isolate the main enemy. Ordinary people of faith are not the main enemy when it comes to tackling abuses of human rights. They don't have power. They are largely powerless. They are often themselves victims of religious tyranny. The religious people with the power to threaten human rights are the clerics and their autocratic clerical institutions. They are the major threat to liberty and freedom worldwide. And it's time we said so. Thank you.
Okay, can we have some questions, please? Right, I see a hand over there. Could you please get the microphone to that person? Thank you.
Hello. At the beginning of your speech, you criticized the capitalist economic system. I just wanted to know what alternative you see to the capitalist system.
Well, of course, there have been many experiments down the ages to try and provide an alternative, and all of them have failed. Often failed because of the conflict between equality and liberty. And to me, I don't see that there should be a conflict. I don't see how you can have equality without liberty. Any organization of society should have both. But in terms of how we might move to a different kind of economy, there are many, many different ways. We don't have to have a revolution, or at least certainly not a violent revolution, but we could introduce, just to begin with, a whole new set of constraints and regulations on a global scale to ensure that the global economic system was fairer and more transparent. Right now, there's a big issue around the financial crisis. There are a whole raft of ideas how to solve this. One of the ideas is, of course, the financial transactions tax, which would be on not just currency exchanges, but also bonds, commodities, and so on. This could raise staggering amounts of money, which could be put into a global fund to combat poverty. For many years, I've argued that we should seek global agreement to cut military spending by 10%. Not 50%, just 10%. Just 10%. A very modest aim. But that would raise a staggering 160,000 million US dollars a year. 160,000 million US dollars a year, which, if put into a global fund to combat poverty, could within 25 to 30 years completely eradicate global hunger and malnutrition, ensure clean, safe drinking water for everyone on this planet, ensure basic housing, education, and healthcare. So I think, you know, we need to start thinking about alternatives. At a global level, quite clearly, I think we need to look at a whole range of issues around world trade, the way in which the whole world trade system is rigged in favor of the richer nations. So that today, to secure the same amount of technology from the West, poorer countries had to export even higher proportions of their raw materials and basic products. That skew-whiffing of the global imbalance in trade mitigates against poorer countries ever being able to get out of poverty. Ultimately, of course, I would like to see some kind of a socialist society where the economy was organized on the basis of people's needs rather than profits for private individuals or corporations. Precisely how we do that, that's a matter for greater minds than mine. But surely and clearly, in this age of new technology and information technology, there must be ways in which we can find systems to marry the resources we have on this planet with people's needs. You know, we do have enough riches in this world to ensure that everyone has the basics of a quality life.
Thank you. I see a hand up over there. Could you please? Thank you, Dan. Could we turn the microphone on, please? Is it gone? Okay. Can we get another microphone, please, to the... Thank you very much.
Well, I certainly agree with your last note that the biggest enemy at the moment we are facing are religious clerics. My biggest question is that in the West, you have managed to at least to marginalize them or contain them, and they don't interfere in your legal system or in anything, while they are rising like anything in the Middle East and Islamic countries. And you could see the double standard with Western governments immediately running and supporting them reaching to power while, you know, wasting taxpayers' money as well with their support and aid. I'd like to, I think it's about time. Yes, we need to be more courageous, and we talk about this. And the only way we can challenge religious clerics is by argument in the religion, you know, itself. As in the West, again, you have the freedom of speech, but we are denied in the Middle East. Where do you think the Western governments could stand? And why do they keep funding this kind of peace conferences here and there while we need something, another method? What do you think? How we can silence or at least sort of challenge the government as to, I don't want my money to go into that part of the world to support these people. Thank you.
I don't think a solution lies in what Western governments do. I think the solution lies in solidarity with people in Muslim countries who are secularist or liberal religious people, building alliances with them, supporting them, empowering them to challenge the autocracy and tyranny within their faith. I was very heartened that some years ago, Sheikh Kakwani of Iran, a son of one of the great grand Ayatollahs of Iran, wrote a paper where he argued that Islam was compatible with democracy and human rights. Perhaps not quite as radical as I would write it, but nevertheless, a very groundbreaking, important document from a very highly esteemed Islamic cleric. I've been very surprised that despite all my efforts to get his words published in the West, no one's really interested. And I think he should be at the next secularism conference because we do need, I think, to give a platform to people from all faiths who are speaking out against religious tyranny and privilege and who do want to see, like us, a liberal secular society. Sheikh Ikhwani is now exiled in Britain. He was hunted by the Iranian authorities. He was living in, I think, Qatar for a while and Abu Dhabi. But because of threats to kill him, he's come here. He now has asylum here. He's in this country. He deserves a platform.
Thank you. Could we take the chat there, and then we'll, first, please, and then we'll come to you later, sir.
Hello. My question for you is this. As you noticed, at the very start of the question session, the first question you had was a comment on the economic issue you brought up at the start. Do you see that there's possibly a danger in intertwining an argument against the current economic system with an attempt to change the place of religion in society? Don't you think that possibly bringing both of those together, those two fights into one issue, increases the difficulty of actually having any real success in changing things?
I think they are two separate issues, but because I'm a human rights campaigner and because this is about the issue of what is the single greatest threat globally to human rights, I think it was right and important that I mention the fact that human rights are much broader than just questions of liberty and conscience. I agree that, you know, you can have these two different strands or ideas working in parallel, separately, together, however you like. But I do agree that when it comes to the focus on the role of religion in public life in this country and around the world, it's probably better to focus on that. But I think we should also be mindful of other human rights issues that are not directly related to the religious. I think, for me, all human rights are universal and indivisible. They're all interrelated. And we should not just simply focus on one faction of human rights to the neglect of others.
Thank you. There was a question. There was a chap there who had his hand up earlier. Where are you? Yes, he's behind you there. That's right. He's on the edge of the aisle. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Major tensions in the world is coming from Middle East, in particular Israel and Palestine. But Western powers, unfortunately, are reluctant to address this issue. How do you see this one?
I couldn't entirely hear it, I think. Western powers, go on.
Major tensions is coming from Middle East, in particular Israel and Palestine. Western powers are reluctant to address this particular issue. How do you see?
What was the first word? I couldn't.
Major tensions.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Okay. One, two.
Yeah, I agree that.
Yes. They are working.
Oops.
Yeah. Sorry, technical.
Do you know how to use it?
I agree that the conflict in the Middle East, the Israel-Palestine conflict, is a very, very important one, and one that is sadly neglected by not just Western leaders, but much of the international community.
Yeah, that's a really well put song.
I think it's very important we don't see these issues in terms of the West versus the rest. This is a global humanitarian issue, and the rights of the Palestinian people are absolutely fundamental to the future. And there are religious fanatics on both sides, in Israel with the extreme Orthodox Jews, and Palestinians and Arab side with extreme jihadists and fundamentalists. There are those people from those two camps that are doing their damnedest to prevent a resolution, and the way in which Israel has, for example, tolerated extremist settlers building houses in the occupied West Bank is not conducive to peace and not at all conducive to Israel's long-term security, because that is feeding fundamentalism and feeding jihadists. I would like to see Israel make a grand gesture to announce unilaterally its withdrawal from the West Bank and other occupied territories, and to agree to fund a new independent Palestinian state. If Israel did that, it would pull the rug out from underneath the fundamentalists. It would throw them off balance. And I believe that most Palestinian people do want to live in peace with their Jewish neighbors, and that they can and will do in the future. All that we can do is, I guess, support those people in both Israel and Palestine who want a genuine peace settlement and who do recognize that as much as Jewish people have a right to live in peace and security, the Palestinians also deserve a homeland and their right to self-government and determination.
Right, we've got time for one last question, please. Okay, we have a hand up over there. Could you keep your hand up, please, and let someone come to you? Thank you.
Hello. You said that perhaps people of faith should not be criticised, but I would argue that to an extent they facilitate the actions of their leaders. For example, by attending, say, Catholic Church on a Sunday, you do, in a sense, endorse the actions and even abuses of the Vatican and, say, the Pope.
Hey, Natalie.
Hi.
Yep. What's it like being grossly overweight?
I didn't say they shouldn't be criticised. I'm just trying to say that I don't think they are the main enemy when it comes to defending human rights, when it comes to defending liberty and freedom. I think the clear power and responsibility lies with religious leaders and organised religion. And even then, not all of them, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu has so eloquently demonstrated. We should, of course, have a debate, a discussion with people of faith, to question the irrationality and superstition of that belief. And that is right and proper. But when it comes to defending human rights, I think the most pressing, important priority thing is to isolate those who are the true cause of abuses, to unite the many against the few. Because every successful campaign is based upon mobilizing the maximum number of people to isolate the perpetrators of injustice and tyranny. That's the way you win campaigns. And if that means aligning with and involving people of faith in our struggle, if they believe in human rights, then I'm happy to do it, because united we are stronger.
Could you please give a very warm welcome to thanks to Peter Thatcher. Thank you very much.
This was a special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical, rationalist, pro-secularist point of view. Essentially, if you like what you've just heard, then you'll like our weekly podcast as well. Head over to poddelusion.co.uk to find out more. But for now, thanks for listening.